I am not a biblical scholar. I work as a lawyer at Valparaiso University. But over the years of my work as a lawyer, I've had the privilege of entering into deep and conversations that have been very profound and moving to me with my brothers and sisters of Israel and of the other people of the book, Muslims. Above all, when I went to Los Angeles, I began more contact with Muslims. And over the period of the last 10, 20 years of my life, I've been involved in some conversations that have truly shaped my own appreciation of how to be a Christian in the face of the claims of two other peoples of the book, that we're all children of Abraham and Sarah. No, I take that back. Muslims trace their ancestry to Abraham, but through Hagar and Ishmael. But in any event, when they say our father, they mean Abraham. And it was thought that as part of the theme that the directors of Holden Village has set for this summer, of a whole new world, that one of the tasks that we should set for ourselves to try to accomplish before leaving here is to get a better sense of the wholeness and the connection with Jews and with Muslims. The short period of time in which I'm going to be here means that I'm not going to develop the theme of our relationship with Muslims. But I have tried last week through a series of exploration on the central building blocks of the Hebrew Bible, the story of the binding of Isaac, which deals with the promise to our ancestors of the progeny so numerous that you could go out tonight on a night like this and look up into the heavens and try to count the stars and figure out even the number of pieces of sand in this small fireplace, let alone all of the seashores and lakesides of the world. And that's the image that God uses for the children of Abraham. That promise comes into strange conflict with his commandment at the outset of Genesis 22, in which the father of many nations is told to kill his dear darling son, who is the hope of the promise. And we're going to see this afternoon the way in which in the Christian centuries, Jews were tempted to reshape that narrative, to retell it in a very different way, in the face of Christian hostility. In its original setting in Canaan, it would have had the clear, unmistakable ring that this story was set down to teach all of its hearers, all of its readers, not to yield to the too easy way of being assimilated into the culture of the surrounding religious ways of the people of Canaan, who thought that fertility would be achieved and that they would have happiness and long life in the land with lots of children and lots of sheep in their flock, that the firstborn of their children were literally burned in a holocaust, which simply means a burnt offering, to the god Moloch, and that then fertility would be assured to that family. This practice of the Moabites, about which those of you who heard Fred Niedner this morning will know that there was intense hatred in Israel against the Moabites, was contradicted by the story of the binding of Isaac, that you shall not lay a hand, comes this other second voice. And then the second passage that I looked at was the Passover narrative, with its imagery of blood taken from an existing Canaanite worship service, in which not the firstborn child, but the firstborn of the flock, the little lamb, would have its blood splattered on the tent pegs, the posts around this big, huge tent, and then around the village, so to speak, as a way of keeping the spooks out. The imagery was that it would keep evil spirits away from the herd and they wouldn't die. It was a long time before animal husbandry would have come up with the explanation of Endomema histolytica or some such scientific thing like that. They just knew that the lambs died and that there had to be some way of stopping that from happening. And so they had this custom each spring, in the beginning of their year, the year always began in springtime in the Near East, of spilling the blood in this way. The tribes who rebelled against the dictator of in Egypt gave a new historical dimension to this story by referring it to their own liberation from Egypt in the Passover meal and the Passover sacrifice, so that the lamb that was roasted so that all could participate in would have the same symbolism, the same communal cultural meaning of the vitality and community staying together and being protected by being at one and in harmony with one another. There was another festival known as the a week-long festival, not a single day as the Shepherd's Festival was, but a full week-long day of the people who were sort of the gatherers or the bakers or whatever, the city folks, as opposed to the folks who tend the sheep out in the pastures. And that was called the Feast of Unleavened Bread, or the Feast of Matzah, we would call it in Hebrew. Matzot is the plural. And for a full week, you don't have the usual yeast that makes the bread rise anywhere to be found in your house. The house would be completely cleansed of the old, and a brand new beginning would take place. Well, again, the tribes that came into Canaan out of their experience of liberation from Egypt adopted that, gave it a historic reference to their own liberation. Why? They said, well, just as the blood of the lamb sprinkled on the doors down in Egypt gave a clue to the avenging angels whether to, and the verb in Hebrew means to kind of take a flying leap in belly. Now that's a pisach, you know, you leap into the air, you know, it's not quite as graceful as Baryshnikov, but you get the idea, is that the angel would leap over that house, and then it had the doubly powerful significance of both life and death for the Egyptians. But here, the same idea was present in the idea of the unleavened bread. Why couldn't you bake bread the way we have it at Holden? Well, because we had to get out of there in a big hurry. It was our night to split. And so we didn't have time to bake bread. And that historical dimension is added to the pagan festival and it takes on a brand new meaning. We saw too that Jesus the Jew, not having the gift of living with the Confessio Augustana or the Book of Common Prayer or the Roman Missal or something like that, he prayed in the only way a Jew knew how to pray, which was the invocation of the Psalms of ancient Israel to give praise to his Father. And he prayed the Hillel Psalms, the Hallel Psalms, I should say, the praise Psalms on the night before he died. And according to the three first Gospels, the first three Gospels, he did so in the setting of a Passover meal. And again, we find that a Jew is at work in transforming the meaning of the festival and giving a brand new historic reference. For us, it is, of course, the saving death of Jesus on the cross. He is imaged in much of the New Testament literature as the perfect Passover lamb. In John, he doesn't have a Passover meal with his disciples because the very moment in which he carries his cross, as Isaac carried his wood out of the city, as the scapegoat went out of the city on Yom Kippur, so Jesus bears the sins of the world and goes out both as under the imagery of scapegoat and as the lamb to be immolated, the lamb to be slain. In any event, the bread that is then associated, well, he says in the supper of the cup of blessing that this cup is the new covenant in my blood shed for you. And similarly, of the bread, which is simply an Aramaic way of saying this is me, this is really myself, I'm giving everything that I can, it is my totality, there is nothing more that I can give, and this is it. So that when we eat this bread and drink this cup, we are proclaiming the death of the Lord Jesus. So Christians then, as they gathered, began to fill in the story of who Jesus was, especially the passion narrative, with the great building blocks of the material of the Hebrew Bible. There was no antagonism towards Jews. They were Jews. There was a dispute among Jews about who Jesus was. Not all of the Jews in Jerusalem agreed that he was the long-expected one, and we studied last week the songs of the strange and mysterious servant identified by the prophet Isaiah in chapters 40 to 55, as one who would be set apart to announce a legal verdict, the conclusion of a trial. And the plaintiff was God, was Yahweh, and the defendants were all the other gods of the Babylonian pantheon. And this strange servant is told to announce it to all the Gentiles, what the result of that trial is. And the result is God wins, that he's the real God, and all the other gods are declared to be a legal nullity. You know, a contract that isn't enforceable and that isn't worth much. That's all they come up with. It's reflected in an image in one of the Psalms that talks about the statues of the idols of the Babylonian pantheon, that they're kind of empty and hollow, much as the verdict in this trial had demonstrated, that they have eyes but don't see, they have ears but can't hear, they have mouths but can't speak. What kind of a God is that? Says the psalmist derisively. So again, the early community is incorporating all of these scriptures, the only scripture they have. They don't have the benefit of New Testament any more than Jesus had the benefit of the Book of Common Prayer or the Lutheran Book of Worship. They weren't around there in Jerusalem at that time. Queen Elizabeth and Queen Edward hadn't gotten around to reforming the Roman papist way of doing things yet, and Martin Luther hadn't done his bit in Germany. So you do it the way you know how to do it. You pray the way you were trained to pray. You pray with the same conviction and fervor of any Jewish lad, trained as he was. For example, it's no surprise that the Gospels would have us believe that he died praying the "Now I lay me down to sleep" prayer. Namely, "Father, into your hands I commend my spirit." That's the prayer that every little Jewish kid says before they go to bed. So it's perfectly clear that Jesus incorporates the spirituality of his times and makes it his own. It's part of his proclamation of the kingdom coming, kingdom and breakthrough of God's rule, I should say. It's a better translation. Kingdom tends to have us, in our imagination, thinking of castles and crowns and kings and queens and that sort of thing. And it's very clear that that's anything but what Jesus has in mind by his gospel, his good news. Then I concluded on Saturday, on Shabbat, which was also a wedding day around here, with the joyfulness of what the Psalms can mean as a form of communal worship. And in each case, I was trying to help us as Christians to see that we really need to reappropriate the Hebrew Bible and make it our own, to repudiate the error or heresy of the late first century, early second century figure by the name of Marcion, who said that we don't need the Hebrew Bible. We have in Christ and in the community of the church all that is needed for spirituality. We don't need that other stuff. That's Old Testament. And we have the New Testament, that which is the perfect fulfillment and drawing to perfection anything that was promised in the past. And we've got it. We're the right stuff, baby. We're the community. Well, no, that even if it were just a kind of a cheap commercial set-off between Jews and Christians, that one were Coca-Cola and the other were Pepsi, it'd be okay. But the thing is that the anti-Jewish attitudes get started rather early, precisely out of the need to search for an answer to the question, who is Jesus? Because the earliest testimonies to who he was arose out of the Hebrew Bible. They used categories like Christ, which is not his family name. I used to grow up as a kid thinking, it was Joseph Christ, Mary Christ, and they had a little boy called Jesus Christ. It's a title like President Bush or whatever else. Pastor Inquist, for those of you that know Garrison Keillor. It's a title. It's has something to do with an office, a function. And for Jews, it encapsulates a precise hope of the restoration of a rule of peace and justice. But it's to be achieved in a dramatically different way than what popular expectation would have it, namely through suffering rather than through throwing the Roman rascals out. Now we'll get on to today's theme in just a minute. I say that anti-Jewish attitudes get started rather early in the Christian story, but that let me differentiate that very sharply from anti-Semitism. By anti-Semitism, I mean something like the cultural attitude of superiority that is best or more easily grasped in our circumstances in North America by reference to the whites who came to this continent roughly 500 years ago. The English ancestors came later, and still later the Norwegians, Swedes, Irish, and so forth. But this is, after all, a land of great immigration. But when the first whites came here, they came to accomplish a variety of purposes, some of which are being explored in a series of talks by Edna Rabine. You might take a look at her tapes, what she has to say about the coming of Christopher Columbus. So it's all part of this theme of the summer of a whole new world. And we're also going to be exploring about the people who were here at the time that our ancestors got here. Will Rogers, who was half Cherokee, gave a famous talk to the Daughters of the American Revolution, who were the purest of the blue blood in Boston, Massachusetts, and who were notorious for their snobbish and exclusive attitudes towards who was a real American. And they didn't know that he was Cherokee, and they sort of invited him because they knew he was humorous and he was a lot of fun to be with. He poked fun at everybody, including the president. He had a wonderful imitation of Cal Coolidge that fooled several radio stations, and he put out a broadcast once that was a senior president speaking and carried on for nearly 15 minutes before they realized it was Will Rogers. But in any event, on this occasion, he reminded the Daughters of the American Revolution that when your folks got here to these shores, mine were here to greet you. And then he very gently laid out the problem of what it looks like from the downside. Well, that's kind of what I would like to do in this remaining portion of this time together this afternoon, is to say what Christian history looks like from the Jewish side. It's a story that is painfully familiar to any educated Jew. I can't even send us who are educated Christians with a sort of a homework assignment, not that anyone at home would ever do that, but I couldn't, if I wanted to, send you to the library next door to the Encyclopedia Britannica to read the article on the Holocaust, because there isn't any. I couldn't, if I wanted to, send you to most volumes on church history and ask you to read the chapter on how in the fourth century the church fathers began preaching with hostility and venom and hatred towards the Jews, because the chapter's missing. It isn't in the book. You have to sort of dig here, there, and everywhere to find what really went on in church history. And as I say, Jews are painfully familiar with this story. They know it backwards and forwards, in part because one of their commandments after the Holocaust is the two words, Lo Zikur, never forget. They say that in part because they do not wish a repetition of the atrocity of the Holocaust, but they also do so in the same spirit of Jesus of Nazareth, namely, do this in memorial of me. It's the same commandment. Never forget, do this in memorial of me. It means make present, make real here and now the reality of my death. For Christians, that's a festive celebration, as any of you who joined in Eucharist last night would know. And we're going to explore that very thing of Jesus is the bread of life on Wednesday and show the Jewish background of what our central faith about Lord's Supper is all about. But for now, for this afternoon, I would just like to work for a few more minutes, maybe 20, 30 more minutes, with you on the assumption that you're not familiar with the story of what happened. As I said, the basic building blocks of Hebrew history start with the Passover. The people who come into the land have some tribes who have older memories of ancestors, Abraham and Sarah, Isaac and Jacob, and so forth. But the basic story of Israel begins with the narrative of her liberation. And already in that narrative, there's a sense of hostility and tension that's built in towards the Egyptians. They, after all, are the primary victims of the story of destruction at the Sea of Reeds. That is the song of victory for Miriam, that the waters mean life for her people, but death for the Egyptians. So it's heavy stuff right from the beginning. What is important to realize, though, is that at the hands of the people who shape the narrative and who reshape it and who tell it again and who tell it differently from all different angles over many different centuries, they're always thinking about their audience here and now. And so when they're retelling it, when they say Egyptians, they don't mean some other nation down there in a place that is remote from them. They mean the trouble is, in our community, there's a lot of you out there that think you're behaving like Egyptians. You're behaving like masters. You're treating your slaves poorly. You're not giving them a day off. And so take a look at the difference in the Ten Commandments, for example, in Exodus chapter 20 and in Deuteronomy chapter 5. And you see that there's a very different reason for the commandment of the Sabbath in those two versions of the Ten Commandments. Typically, Christians only remember the commandment about keep holy the Lord's Day, and that's it, period. We don't go into the rest of it. We edit out of our commandments the biblical text. We do that too often, in fact, with the biblical text. But check that one out, whether there's a difference between Exodus 20 and Deuteronomy 5, and ask yourself why. And I'll give you a clue. It's because the person who's retelling the tale is always concerned with trying to get through. So the animosity isn't really towards some political enemy out there external to the people of God. It's rather that reform, as Martin Luther knew, was an inside job. Something that has to go on within the church. It has to go on to reshape this misshapen figure of the community of God. The encounters that next occur, I don't think really were ever transcended in the life of Israel. Maybe they will within our lifetime, which is where I hope to conclude, if not in today's remarks, then setting aside some time, either for a forum, we're going to have a discussion about the political ramifications of some of these ideas, or, you know, catch me at coffee break or whatever. But the next set of enemies are the people that they encounter in the wilderness, the Moabites, the Ammonites, and the like. And there you get all kinds of real hostility told and acted out, both in the Psalms, Psalm 139, I think it was even sung communally here in this room this morning in the Bible study for those of you that were here. That must have been quite a feeling, you know, cursing your enemies. There is a way of retrieving those Psalms that does so, again, by realizing that conversion or reform is an inside job. It is not some external enemy out there. But the fact of the matter is that the literal blood descendants, not those who are descendants by faith, as Paul would have us believe in Romans 4, of Abraham, but rather, you know, the people whom we will identify as Jews, thought of the Moabites as their arch enemy. And they image them in every possible way with all the hatred that they could muster. Then come the Canaanites, the Philistines, even to this day, to call a person a Philistine may sound a little bit hoity-toity, but we're probably used to the idea of calling somebody a son of a bitch. Harry Truman got into a lot of trouble for calling a critic in the Washington Post a son of a bitch once because he gave a poor review of his daughter Margaret playing the piano. And it was a scandal that the President of the United States would use language like that. But that, of course, is exactly what Israel says about the Moabites and the Ammonites. It tells this tale of Lot, you know, getting so drunk one night, and he sleeps with his daughters, first this one, first the other one, and he didn't even know what he's doing. So it's a kind of a, you know, you're sure you may have once in your life heard, if not told, an ethnic joke of one sort or another. Italians tell Italian jokes, Irish tell Irish jokes. It becomes offensive when non-Poles tell Polish jokes and so on. But you get the point, is that these are Ammonite jokes, these are Moabite jokes. Oh, you know where the Moabites come from? That sort of thing. And they're deliberately filled with all kinds of antagonism and hatred and venom that literally has not been resolved to this day, to this moment, as we're sitting here. There's still this kind of deep, deep, intense, unresolved hatred among Semites, among people who are of one strain, and hence we have to be careful about what does this term anti-Semitic mean. Well, I wanted to differentiate it at the outset, and I don't think I did as careful a job as I might. Anti-Semitism, I think, not only has no place in the life of the Christian community, it certainly is an oxymoron or a contradiction in terms that you could talk, as I've entitled our session this afternoon, of Christian anti-Semitism. It just means that many leaders of the Christian church over the centuries have been anti-Semitic. That's all it means. It doesn't mean that it's Christian. It just means that we've done this. And we need to be familiar with that so as to extirpate it and get rid of it. Cleanse it from our hearts. It doesn't add anything to our Christian spirituality. To the contrary, it violates the very nature of our understanding of who Jesus was and of who we ought to be. But anti-Jewishness or anti-Judaism can have a certain truth to it in terms of what the earliest Christians had to deal with about the answer to the question, who is Jesus? We'll get to that in a minute. Now, I think that distinction between anti-Judaism and anti-Semitism, a very important one, should be held in mind for the rest of our conversation. That's the reason why I flashed back to that one and tried to back up and fill that in a little bit. Is there anyone who has a doubt or a question about that particular point? Please feel free to comment on it, or if not, then I'll just go back to my chronological narrative.
So the Semites were the people that living in the Near East at the time, Jews as well as Moabites and Canaanites?
Yeah, technically the term the Jews only refers to one of the 12 tribes, the people of Judah. Then the term the Jews kicks in only in the Persian period, and I'll sort of get to that in the chronological sequence in a minute, but flashing forward, it means the time after the return from the Babylonian exile to the time of the time of the so-called Second Temple. Those are what we would more correctly call Jews. And then among the Jews, what is more important to realize with respect to the charges that Christians have hurled against them is that there were obviously some Jews in Jerusalem, but there were also some Romans. Jews weren't running the world at the time. It was the Roman Empire was very well organized, thank you, with legal administration, a military garrison, and a governor that really ran the whole shebang. So who has responsibility for the death of Jesus? Let's start with the easy one. Let's call everybody who is a child of Abraham the Jews. Now, would it be fair to say that the Jews killed Jesus, if that's what you mean by the term, the Jews?
Yes.
Well, for openers, a lot of them lived before Jesus, never heard of him. Okay, so let's maybe bracket those folks. Maybe let's bracket the Jews who were, say, living in the diaspora, who were down in Alexandria in Egypt, which is the largest Jewish community outside of Jerusalem, just as Los Angeles or New York is a far larger community of Jews in the world today than any other city, including Jerusalem. More Jews in Los Angeles than in New York than in Jerusalem or in Tel Aviv. But just for to bracket those people who were alive at the time of the Passover of 14th Nisan and that year in which Jesus died. But will we make them guilty for something they had no idea was going on? Well, the common law that we inherit from England would say, no, we wouldn't make them guilty because a person has to have a guilty mind. And they clearly did, if they didn't know about it, how can they be guilty of something like that? Then what about us? St. Paul says that we are the heirs of the promise of Abraham. Are we the deicide race? I mean literally us. I mean you, buddy. I mean me. I mean, you know, right around the room. I mean us here. I mean some other foreign group. I mean us. Did you kill Jesus? Well, there's a certain sort of pietistic way in which we retrieve the memory of the death of Jesus. You hear this, especially hymns in Lent, that go along that way, thinking, oh, poor Jesus, you know, I put you to your death, my sins, etc., like that. That's simply a way of entering personally into the narrative that we retrieve the idea of grace and forgiveness that comes from Jesus' death. But it would be ludicrous if I were then to call the sheriff and bring a capital case against him to execute him for that. That would miss the point entirely of the story, which is rather that you're forgiven. You're filled with grace and you're beholden to God. We're told to try to work puns into our narrative whenever we can, so you'll have to forgive me for that. But you can see how, in a minute, the Christian tradition about Calvary, which can be for us a source of rich associations with grace, forgiveness, pardon, healing, and so on, could go the other way and get nasty once you start to turn the story into a blame and an accusation and a fault-finding deal. Who killed Jesus? Well, what's the answer of the early creed? Does anybody remember enough from your Sunday school training from either the Nicene Constantinopolitan Creed or the Apostles' Creed? What's the answer to that question that the early church formulated into its official statement of faith? Pontius Pilate. How does it go?
Crucified under Pontius Pilate.
Suffered, died, and is buried under Pontius Pilate. Now, why do you think historically that's a correct rendition of the legal consequences of who is doing what? Because the Sanhedrin in Jerusalem had no jurisdiction, as we say in law, no power over death penalty cases, had no capital punishment authority. Any execution that occurred in Palestine, which was simply the Roman name for the place, it's not a Hebrew name, Palestina, had to have been through Roman authority. In any event, whatever the historical circumstances, some of the Jewish authorities clearly rejected the invitation of Jesus that God's rule was breaking in all around them, that they had placed unbearable burdens upon the people, and that he was calling as a rabbi for a purification and a renewal. They were opposed to all that. Sometimes it's set up as though he's the political enemy of the empire. In John's gospel, that's the way it's made to be seen, that if you let this guy off, then you are no friend of Caesar. And an even more blasphemous way in John's passion narrative, remember that John is writing at the end of the century, at the time of the Emperor Domitian, when the emperor wants to be worshipped as my Lord and my God, the very way that the so-called doubting Thomas, but who is really the faithful Thomas in the end, identifies who Jesus is. And it's inconsistent if doing that in emperor worship and at one another's home as you're doing Lord's Supper. You can't say Jesus is Lord and also say Caesar is Lord. Hence, for that reason, it was pretty easy that Christians couldn't serve in the military, because the sacrament, or a sacramentum in Latin, or oath of office that they would have to take was Caesar is Lord. They couldn't do that consistently. It would be like asking Jews to violate the first commandment by having another god. That is the nexus between Jews and Christians in the first century. They are wrestling first together and then as communities apart from one another about who Jesus is. Some want to say he is my Lord and my God, my Yahweh, my Adonai. Jews to this day won't even begin to pronounce the name Yahweh. They won't even say so much as Yah, because that's getting too close to you know, buddy-buddy relationship with God, and that's not how they think of him. They think of him as the transcendent Lord, so they fill in Adonai at that point. Now, we spent an awful lot of time in the ancient world thinking about who were the enemies of the Jews. I'd like now to tell the story of how the Jews became the enemies of the Christians. We have sketched out last week. I'm not going to go into it at any great length now. This is the Egyptians, the Moabites, Ammonites, Canaanites, Philistines, Assyrians come and destroy the northern tribes. You never hear of those 10 tribes again. Then come the Babylonians, who destroy Jerusalem, totally obliterate the temple, take people off into Babylon, into the exile. And then the Persians, who send them back, but with limited authority, limited rule. Alexander the Great, beginning the Hellenistic period in the 4th century, then the Romans, and now, the worst of all, the Christians. The Christians were more devastating to Jewish faith than any of the ancient enemies of Israel. And it's that dimension of the story that we rarely hear and that we need to focus on. Let me first just read one tiny little selection from an ancient Roman historian who is not a Christian. He's one of the pagans, but who is one of the pagan historians. But he's one of the sources of what we know about this story, Tacitus. He's one of the great anti-Semites, in the sense of anti-Jewish, hostile, violent writers of all time. He says of them, "The Jews are descended from lepers who were exiled or expelled from Egypt. They followed a band of wild asses out of the desert to a spring of abundant water. From these rites are derived the way they get together, rites contrary to those of all other peoples. They worship an ass, which is consecrated in Jewish temples. They abstain from pork in remembrance of their leprosy, a disease to which the pig is subject. Their use of unleavened bread symbolizes the bread they stole in Egypt. Their Sabbath commemorates the day in which they escaped and to which in their laziness and indolence they have become attached. Of all enslaved peoples, they are the most contemptible, a loathsome people, at once full of superstition and hostile to all religious practice, a people whose customs are absurd and sordid. All that we Romans hold sacred is profane to them. All that is licit to them is impure to us." That's a pretty stark contrast that we would say, well, what can you expect from someone who hasn't been gifted with Christian insight? This, after all, is not a member of the Christian community at Rome. He hasn't heard the good news of Jesus. He's not familiar with the promises of Abraham. He's seeing it as an outsider. And so we kind of forgive Tacitus his violence because he's ignorant. But can we be so easy on ourselves? To be sure, we can find reasons for why the leaders of the Christian community would start to write in an anti-Jewish way when Jews are trying, out of devotion to the first commandment, to insist to Christians, look, don't compromise this issue about God being one. If you say Jesus is Lord, if you say he is truly God, then what are you saying about the first commandment? And to be sure, the Christian community would have to wrestle with that question for nearly two, three centuries. before I would figure out in the Nicene Creed and then the decrees of the Council of Ephesus and the Council of Chalcedon, a way of figuring out how do we keep this mystery of Jesus truly human and truly divine from shattering our basic conviction in the oneness of God. And there will be many errors along the way. There'll be people who are saying, well, there are really three gods, proving the point of the Jewish objection. How can you do that? If you do that, you're going to obliterate any sense of being the true people of God. So it's at this point in the struggles and controversies over who Jesus is that sometimes we start hearing language that comes close to being like that of Tacitus. Let me read, for example, some of the language of I'm going to skip very quickly here since time is running out, of a 4th century bishop known as John Chrysostom, Golden Tongue, the bishop of Antioch. At this time he went on to become the patriarch of Constantinople and leader of the entire Eastern Church. So a person of very high station and respect and admiration. He's writing in the critical century for the deterioration of Christian-Jewish relations, the 4th century, and I'll say something about that in a minute or two to give you the context, but right now let me just read from what he told his congregation. See what difference, if any, you find between Tacitus and John Chrysostom some centuries later. Of their rape, their cupidity, their deception of the poor, their thievery, and their huckstering, of these matters, a whole day would not suffice to tell all. The they in question are the Jews. But, learned bishop that he is, he gives it a shot. Even though it would take a full day, he's going to try to do this in one sermon. In fact, he goes on to give 6 sermons in the same vein, describing the sort of anti-Jewish attitude that he has. How can you dare have the slightest conversation with a Jew, he asks. They are the most miserable of all. They are lustful, rapacious, greedy, perfidious bandits. They are inveterate murderers, destroyers, people possessed by the devil, whom debauchery and drunkenness have given the manners of a pig and a lusty goat. They know only one thing, to satisfy their gullets, to get drunk, to kill and maim one another. Indeed, they have surpassed the ferocity of wild beasts, for they murder their offspring and immolate them to the devil. It was in reading that line of John Chrysostom's sermon that I got the idea to bring to Holden a commentary on the Binding of Isaac story. Let me reread it. They murdered their offspring and immolate them to the devil. That is exactly the Christian taunt about Genesis 22 that was circulating in the Christian community that forced the rabbis then to take a new look at that text and to begin to interpret it quite differently. I want to finish about John Chrysostom, but then I'm going to come back to this point about the Binding of Isaac in the context of the Crusades. What is the synagogue, he asks. And he's preaching in Greek. And the term synagoge simply means the assembly. It has a secular connotation in the ancient world. It means the place where people would gather for civic occasions to have theater, drama, political events, and one thing or another. It simply means the place where people gather. But by the time he's preaching, it has now come to be differentiated from another secular term, ecclesia, that simply means the church, also having secular connotations, but also having religious connotations, is this word. By the time that he's preaching, it clearly means the place where Jews gathered to worship God. Just as the term church doesn't mean the building so much as the community which gathers in that place. So again, what is the synagogue? That's the question. Not only is it a theater and a house of prostitution, you know, referring to the secular connotation of what that term would have in Greek. But it's a cavern of brigands, a repair of wild beasts. Now these things didn't normally go on in the secular synagogue. let alone in the religious sense. It is a place of shame and ridicule. It is the domicile of the devil, as is every soul of every Jew. Indeed, Jews worship the devil. Their rites are criminal and impure. Their religion is a disease. Their synagogue is an assembly of criminals, a den of thieves, a cavern of devils, an abyss of perdition. These denunciations, and I could go on and on because there's several pages here, but you get the point. These villainous mischaracterizations of our brothers and sisters arose out of the desperate attempt of the church to win the argument about who Jesus was. It's at precisely at this moment of the church's history, the third and into the fourth century, that they then go back to the issue of did you kill Jesus? And they will say, no, you didn't, but the Jews did. And they will mean by that term, the Jews did, not simply those few who were in leadership and in control of the establishment in Jerusalem at the time of the death of Jesus. They will mean by that term the Jews in Antioch at the time of the sermon. They will mean all Jews in all time and give to them the term the deicide race, the race that is being punished, scattered away from their homeland, punished by God because they killed Christ. A more monstrous heresy could not have been invented. At least I don't think so. Heresy always has the possibility of cleansing and purifying the church by enriching us, by making us figure out what is a more adequate answer to the problem that is posed, that there's a truth in somebody else's heresy that needs to be incorporated in after it's been cleansed of its error. But this one, my gosh, what's it got to commend it? Does it give us a better understanding of who Jesus was, of who we are, of who our God is, about the world in which we live? What can we say about this heresy that can help us become better Christians, other than to say that it is the longest of our heresies, it is the oldest of our hatreds, it is the most stubborn virus in the religious community that I'm aware of? And I realize that giving it that label to this afternoon's conversation, the longest hatred, is itself problematic. Someone might say it's men's domination and oppression of women. That's a very old, very sad story, and we need to hear that one. But in terms of a religious heresy, this idea that the Jews killed Jesus, and therefore the Jews are being punished by God throughout history, and it's our task as Christians to be the messengers of death to them, is, I think, the longest hatred in the Christian community. When we wake up in the morning, we really don't think about the Moabites, unless Fred Niedner happens to be sitting here in the chair guiding Bible study. And he did that to enable you to get inside of the problem of hatred, to see how the Bible deals with this theme, for those of you that are here this morning. But normally, we just don't think much about the Moabites. But I bet you there isn't a person here in this room that doesn't think some from time to time in stereotypical ways about Jews, or that hasn't in your life at some moment been influenced by Shakespeare's depiction of Shylock, or by Charles Dickens' depiction of Fagin, or by the Protocols of Zion, one of the most notorious frauds of the 19th century that was designed to get the Tsar of Russia to throw out the Jewish middle class, and was exposed as a fraud, did not achieve that end, but had the ironic, perverse effect of winning in America through the money that Henry Ford sunk into the propagation of that scurrilous thing. He had it translated into dozens of languages. He said, oh yeah, that's what's wrong with the world. It's being run by Jews, the Jewish bankers, the Jewish financiers, and so forth. Whereupon then, of course, an Adolf Hitler could feed right into that and hold up the Treaty of Versailles that meant the humiliation of the German people and link it in the next breath. And you know who causes this? It's die Juden. the Jews, those bankers that have caused this economic depression, and build all kinds of incredibly large leaps beyond data, beyond facts, back to where we're comfortable, to our oldest hatreds, to our oldest stereotypes. Jews got into the business of commerce and into the banking business in the Middle Ages because Christians required them to do so. They were told that they could not be lawyers, that they could not be this and they could not be that. Their land was taken away, their property was taken away, and they were told that they had to violate one of their own commandments, the commandments against taking money for money. Why? Because the Christians had a very, very lofty standard of interpreting the Torah, the Hebrew Bible, which prohibited usury, and far more strict and far more severe than any teaching of the Christian church ever. Honest to God, you can check this out. You find that it is correct as a statement. Far more strict than any teaching of the Christian church with respect to sex was the absolute prohibition on usury. A prohibition which came in time to be changed. We can thank the Florentines and the Venetians for that. The Italians usually figure out a compromise with the Bible. The idea that Tawney proposed that capitalism was blessed by the Protestant Reformation is correct to a certain extent. Calvin certainly brought a lot to bear on that, but he was off by about three centuries. The Italian bankers had already figured out a way of being comfortable with Christianity and having their ducats too. And it's precisely that phenomenon to which Shakespeare is making reference in The Merchant of Venice when he talks in stereotypical terms about Shylock. Many a times you have rated me about my usuries and my monies. You have called me cutthroat dog and cur, and you spat upon my Jewish gabardine. These kinds of subtle ways of getting us to understand who are these people, anyhow, these Jews, were in part what we as a people did to them. Let me just focus on one very tragic moment in that history and then leap forward, because we're kind of going to run out of time quickly and I want you all to participate to some extent here, and that is to tell something of the story of the Crusades. From a Mennonite perspective, or a pacifist perspective, it of course is as much a contradiction in terms as you can imagine, that in the name of the cross, these soldiers would leave England or France or Germany to go conquer the land where Jesus was born and died. Why? Because I guess the radical wing of the Reformation understands that there's a difference between dying and killing. And so they say, well, we won't baptize our kids because we want them to accept Jesus, the dying one, the risen one, as an adult, taking Jesus as Lord and Savior, but neither will we obey the emperor if the emperor tells us that we have to kill someone, because Jesus does not invoke his legion of angels, he dies as the suffering servant. But in the hands of, or in the page of history that we're looking at, this image of the cross of Christ, the suffering at the hands of, you know, many Jews would die this death. 2,000 of them died on one day, executed by the Romans and through crucifixion in the city of Antioch. 20,000 of them were massacred on another occasion. So Jews are familiar with the cross. It's not so they didn't never heard of the cross. They've died on crosses by the thousands. And now to see this cross of Christ turned into a symbol of military conquest doesn't look so good from the Jewish side. Because what they do in the first crusade is go through Germany, as one preacher put it, hey, why are we going so far to find the enemy? Got them right here. And so they first round up the Jews in the ghettos of the various cities in Germany in the first crusade and literally immolate, annihilate various people that they had there. Indeed, in Jerusalem, when they finally got there, one of the first acts of the Crusaders was to round up the Jews into the synagogue and to burn the entire building. That way you could do two Crusaders acts at the one moment. You could burn the Holy Scriptures of Israel, which was thought to be a good thing for which God would reward you, and you could kill Jews. In response to that, various rabbis began reflecting again, retelling the story of the binding of Isaac. And they noticed this fact that at the end of the narrative, in verse 19 of Genesis 22, there's a curious thing that only Abraham goes back to meet the two servants that he's left behind. He goes out with his son Isaac, but he comes back alone. And so they begin to speculate about that. What could that mean? From the 2nd, 3rd century on, Jews have been taunted that the sacrifice of Isaac is pale in significance compared to the sacrifice of Jesus, which goes the full 9 yards, so to speak, in football parlance, and, you know, gets the first down or whatever. That's a very vulgar image, but you get the point of some way of saying this is a much better sacrifice. Christians want to say it is the only sacrifice. No other sacrifice need ever be repeated again, because this is the once for all, this kind of language. And they started taunting the Jews about the sacrifice of Isaac. Whereupon, then Jews started to reinterpret that story to say, well, maybe Abraham did take the life of his son. We're not told that in this story. We're told that he comes back alone. And so they start telling in this imaginative, homiletic way, and then they start going to the task of justifying what would you do with your own kid if a Christian, and now imagine now we're a synagogue and the Crusaders are coming. We know that they're 5 miles away. And we know what they've done to the next village over. They've given two choices. One, you become Christian, or two, we kill you. That's it. And this is what martyrdom looks like from the Jewish side. And so they begin to reflect again on this very passage, on the Genesis 22 narrative of the binding of Isaac. Let me read one of the passages that deals with this. In the community of Worms, does that name ring a bell? Anybody? It's in Diet of, you know, how college kids always call it the Diet of Worms, right? But it's famous in Lutheran history. 800 people were killed in the course of 2 days in the year 1096. Among these were some who, quote, offered up sacrifices of righteousness. That's the technical term that is going to be used in these passages. Who with whole heart took their sons and slew them for the unification of God's glorious and awesome name. That rather than give in on the issue of the sanctification of God's name, by profaning it, by becoming Christians, these people took their own children's lives and justified it in terms of the narrative in Genesis 22. Here is my son whom God gave me. This is the voice of one of the people before the death. And to whom my wife Zipporah gave birth in her old age. Again, a reference to Sarah. Isaac is this child's name, and now I shall offer him up as our father Abraham offered up his son Isaac. And remember that Isaac in Hebrew means laughing boy, darling child, son of joy. Yitzhak literally means ha-ha, because it's so laughable that Sarah in her old age would have a child. And it's this kind of child of joy, child of promise, that from the Jewish side is being forced to be put to death in this way. And not even for a moment shall I delay, for he who, back to this text, for he who gave him to us will take him away to his own portion and lay him to rest in our father Abraham's bosom. Total confidence in the face of death that God will take care of his little one. And he bound his son Isaac, and he picked up the knife to slay his son, and recited the blessing appropriate for slaughter. And the lad replied, Amen. And the father slew the lad. Then he took his shrieking wife, and both of them together left the room, and the vagabonds murdered them. Over such as these, wilt thou hold thy peace, O Lord? That's the question the rabbi puts at the end of the story. These people know that they're going to be slaughtered by the Christians. And rather than put the child to the test of infidelity, he acts the way we pray in the Lord's Prayer. Do not lead us to that final test. Don't even put us into the apocalyptic moment of falling short of your goal of remaining faithful to you. Better that we invoke the Isaac story in a way that is clean contrary, 180 degrees off what the original purpose is meant. Now, some will use this change of the narrative to prove the point of their Christian hatred of Jews. They see, they even kill kids, missing the whole point that it is we who have put them to a distortion of their own scriptures. Let me read a modern poem about the same phenomenon. It is the Abraham story retold for our time. So Abram rose and clave the wood and went and took the fire with him and a knife. And as they sojourned both of them together, Isaac the firstborn spake and said, My father, behold the preparations, fire and iron, but where the lamb for this burnt offering? Then Abram bound the youth with belts and straps and builded parapets and trenches there and stretched forth the knife to slay his son. When lo, an angel called him out of heaven, saying, Lay not thy hand upon the lad, neither do any harm to him. Behold, a ram caught in a thicket by its horns. Offer the ram of pride instead of him. But the old man would not do so, but slay his son, and half the seed of Europe, one by one. Lest you think the poet to have exaggerated, I would like now to pass around some pictures. Maybe they're not for all of you, but they are for one burnt offering that has come collectively to be described as the burnt offering, the Holocaust. It's not that Hitler was much of a Catholic. He was nominally, born and baptized a Roman Catholic. And it's not that Himmler was much of a Lutheran as minister of propaganda. It is rather that the Third Reich appropriated and exploited the long, long story of Christian hatred of Jews that stretches at least from the 4th century, when Christians got to power and started removing the civil liberties that Jews had enjoyed under Roman law, stretching through the Crusades, which were as every bit cruel and violent to the Jews, as anything that the Nazis ever did. Nothing was done to the Jews in the Third Reich that we Christians had not done in the centuries before that. It was just done more efficiently, with a better organized bureaucracy, with a higher skilled group of technocrats, who then wondered, to be sure, about the how of it, how would we get this job done, sort of question, that boggles the mind when you read some of the journals of the people running Bergen-Belsen and the death camps, but what would be more efficient, and the like. It boggles our mind, perhaps, that they were so callous about these people, but there is, as I say, a very long and pathetic Christian dimension to this story, long before the Nazis get their hands on it and manipulate it to make it a matter of mass propaganda under Himmler with the Nuremberg rallies and the like. It's all there in Mein Kampf, to be sure. It's surely there in the Nuremberg Laws from 1933. Everybody should have known. It's what was coming. It's not just that it's all there in Kristallnacht. It's there in the ashes of Anne Frank. It's there in the slime of Auschwitz. It's all that's left of these sons and daughters of Abraham that were reduced to nothing. To be sure, we need to have a memory of these events that incorporates the heroism of those few Christians who resisted the claims of the totalitarian state. Indeed, it's very humbling for me to be in Holden at this moment in the presence of such a one. One of the people in the village was in the Dutch resistance in the 1940s, and I've had a long, long conversation with him about these matters. I went away from that conversation struck with two things. One, his similarity to Miep Gies, the very noble and, in my view, heroic woman who fed Otto Frank and his children and his wife and the other who were eight in that back house that became their place of refuge in Amsterdam. And what I was struck with, both in talking to John here in the village and to Miep in my house in Los Angeles some 5 years ago, was how what to my perspective looks like heroic courage, resisting the incredible power of the Gestapo, was to them the simple, ordinary act of what you do for a neighbor. You know, so there are other dimensions to this story throughout the Christian century. I could have read to you other bishops in the 4th century who were saying, we must remember always to pray for the Jews in our liturgy. They are our brothers and our sister. And that tradition has lasted throughout the Christian centuries as well. I could have invoked some of the monks who said at the time of the preaching of Bernard of Clairvaux, don't you dare lay a hand on one of these people. There is, in short, a minority tradition within Christianity. And I could have told you about the period in Martin Luther's life when he thought that the Jews were okay. But it didn't last very long, folks. He became one of the nastiest and most vulgar anti-Semites of German history. And along with Hegel, and along with a lot of the intellectuals of the 19th century that formed the raw data, the raw material for Himmler to cook up in his cauldron of how to get these people, we have to include, I have to say, Martin Luther as one of the great anti-Semites of German history. You may say back, but that's an improper use of Luther, that if he had been alive in the 20th century, he never would have done that. I don't know. All I know is what he did in the 16th century, which was to justify the dispossession of Jewish property, the burning of their synagogues, the execution of Jews, stuff that is so horrendous that, again, we have to be humble in the face of what the Third Reich did and say, what have they done to the Jews that we haven't done before? And perhaps with not as much efficiency. Because I can't send you to the Encyclopedia Britannica to read the article on the Holocaust, because there isn't any, I thought it would be best to conclude in silence because we have so little to say about these matters, and just pass a book of pictures about the Holocaust around. And then if any of you wish to stay after to discuss these matters, please feel free to do so. And I would be happy to stay here as long as any of you wish to do that. But I thought it would be well to invite you at least to spend another couple of minutes of your life in just looking at some of these pictures. They are more evocative than anything that I could say. All the pictures, all the pages that are bound in black in that volume relate to the chapter on the Holocaust.